Good morning, and welcome to Overeaters Anonymous Vision for You Big Book Study. My name is Janice, and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. Today is Thursday, August 2nd, 2012. Today we are reading from the Big Book on page, in the doctor's opinion, page XXXIII, paragraph 3 is where we're starting. The reference number for yesterday, which was Wednesday, August 1st, is 2792. That's 2792. The OA preamble. Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who, through shared experience, strength, and hope, are recovering from compulsive overeating. We welcome everyone who wants to stop eating compulsively. There are no dues or fees for members. We are self-supporting through our own contributions, neither soliciting nor accepting outside donations. OA is not affiliated with any public or private organization, political movement, ideology, or religious doctrine. We take no position on outside issues. This meeting's primary purpose is to abstain, to recover from compulsive overeating, and to carry this message of recovery to those who still suffer. The sole purpose. OA's fifth tradition states, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. At Vision for You Big Book Study, our message is that people who suffer from compulsive overeating can recover through abstinence and the practice of the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Overeaters Anonymous. I would now like to ask Margaret H. to please read the 12 steps.
Hi, this is Margaret, compulsive overeater. Here are the steps we took. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Pass.
Thank you, Margaret. And now I'd like to ask Robin to read the 12 traditions. Press star 1 to unmute, Robin.
Sorry, this is Robin. I'm a compulsive overeater. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you. How our meeting works. Our meeting focuses on the directions for recovery described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We read a paragraph or two from the literature, then stop and share on what was read. Anyone can share, but we ask that you keep your sharing to topic and literature we are discussing, and that you keep your share to approximately 3 minutes. Singleness of purpose reminds us to identify as compulsive overeaters only. Our abstinence requirements for moderators is 1 year, and for readers is 6 months. There is no abstinence requirement for sharing on topic. This meeting does request that your sharing be directly linked to what was read. We are sharing what the directions in the Big Book mean to us. To share, press star 1 to unmute. Once you are done sharing, let us know by saying pass, then press star 1 to mute your phone. In order to have a quiet meeting and a quiet recording, everyone's phone, except the speakers, should be muted. Today, we resume our study of the Big Book in the Doctor's Opinion, page XXXIII, paragraph 3. And I'd like to ask Rick to start us off. Would you please read, Rick?
Good morning. My name is Rick. I'm a compulsive overeater. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Well, I'm going to go right back to the beginning of that paragraph. If any feel that as psychiatrists, we appear somewhat sentimental, and the way I read that is, anybody that thinks that we're being overly emotional, that's what sentimental means, if we're being too easy on these people, come stand in our shoes and see what we see. Come do our work and watch what goes on in the lives of these people. And it's the same thing with us overeaters. How many times have people told us, just push away from the table, put the fork down, don't eat that dessert? So if you think they're being too easy on us, they're coddling us, that they're being much too nurturing, or we're being too nurturing on ourselves, if people are telling us that, come see what we see. Come see the grave nature of this illness and observe the people that aren't around anymore that have died from this disease. And you'll see how serious these psychiatrists took their work. And it's the same with overeaters. It's a serious, serious illness. And only a compulsive overeater or someone that works with them or someone that's very close knows what it's like. With that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Rick. Would anyone like to share on what was read?
Esther?
Good morning, Esther.
Good morning. My name is Esther. I'm a compulsive overeater in Canada. I also wanted to comment on this word sentimental. I mean, this approach to treating alcoholism, which Dr. Silkworth is supporting, was certainly very new at that time. You know, the allergy of the body, obsession of the mind, spiritual experience. These ideas were probably appeared slightly off or radical, you know, at that time. It's definitely very unscientific approach, and it's not, you know, wasn't typical to doctors. As a matter of fact, in the first edition, excuse me, of the Big Book, Dr. Silkworth did not actually sign his name to the letter that he wrote, not the original short letter, nor this, you know, continuation of the letter that you see here. His name was not there. He probably figured which reputable doctor would support these newfangled ideas. Of course, by the time the second edition came out, when there was already wide acceptance of AA among professionals, at that point his signature was affixed to the letters. But he's in the trenches, and he knows the realities of this disease, and he's seen the good work that, you know, Bill W. and his group have done, and now he stands by his opinion, even if, you know, if they appear sentimental or overly, you know, overly emotional. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. Would anyone else like to share on what was read?
This is Paula. May I share?
Go ahead, Paula.
Thank you. I'm going to go right here to the firing line. You know, we know what a firing line is. And they say what they saw. They saw the tragedies. It isn't just us. The mother that was in the waiting room, the wife, the sister, the children. They saw them all. They saw the look of confusion, perhaps the look of hope. But this part here, it became part of their daily work. Oh, yes, this is what they did. But look, in even of their sleeping moments, even when they put their head on the pillow, they remembered and they saw. This is why I think they said, the most cynical will not wonder. Honey, this is what we saw every day. Don't wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. My goodness, to see hope come alive. And that's what happened with these people. But wait, the people in their lives too. Oh, yes. And it says, we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation. That's what it is. The rehabilitation, the transformation of these men, than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Thank you for allowing me to share. And with that, I do close.
Thank you, Paula. Would anyone else like to share on what was read? Press star 1 to unmute. Thank you, Sonia. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sonia, and I'm a compulsive overeater. And I'm just struck with gratitude this morning that, you know, that Dr. Silkworth was aware and could see this as an illness. I don't think that necessarily there's been such widespread acceptance with doctors with compulsive eating. I ended up with my weight and measured meal on a flight with what I found to be through conversations, sitting next to me a doctor who was on the team that invented the insulin pump for diabetes, and he was commenting on my meal, and we ended up in a two-hour conversation, and I shared with him my story because, you know, I asked him, you know, in the conversation what he did. He told me, and he happened to say, but my passion is the study of what sugar does to the brain. And I said, well, I've been running a numerous decade experiment on what sugar does to my brain, and ended up sharing with him my story. And at the end of 2 hours, and the flight was beginning to descend, he said to me, well, it's great that you found, you know, what you're doing, but we're hoping we can find for you someday, you know, a medication that will allow you to eat whatever you want. And I felt like I had a knife piercing, and I thought, wow, he did not get anything that I just shared with him. And I just said, you know, you could not give me $1 million to take one bite of sugar right now. And he looked at me like, yeah, right. And I was dead serious, mm-hmm. and I feel like that today. You know, thanks mm-hmm. to this program, I have found freedom from that, and I know that there's no drug that would give me freedom from that, nor do I want to bet on that. And I'm so grateful for not having the wanting for that. I never thought that would be possible. And I just pray that someday, you know, there will be a doctor that sees the kind of impact that this program can have that might be able to communicate that to the rest of the medical community, that more people might find the solution, you know, in other ways than just having to stumble into a meeting like I did. And with that, I pass.
Thank you, Sonia. Would anyone else like to comment on what was read? Press star 1 to unmute. All right, we're going to move on to the next paragraph. And Yolanda, would you please read for us?
Hi, this is Yolanda, compulsive overeater. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others take with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. That was just one paragraph, and it just said so much. For me, I so identify with this. And the first part where it says they eat essentially because they like the effects produced, or they drink because they like the effects produced. I love the effects produced by sugar and other foods, but mainly by sugar. And for a long, long time, I couldn't understand that it doesn't work for me, that I have a problem with it. And I couldn't make the difference between the true from the false, because as long as I was able to have that sugar, I would always, my mind would tell me that it's okay and I can try it again and it's going to be okay. And then this paragraph goes on into what happens when I don't get it, that restless, irritable, and discontent and the spree. And just like I said, there's just so much I could talk an hour on this paragraph, but I just want to say that the phenomenon of a craving that they speak about, it took me years and years and years to finally understand that. And today, I understand it. You know, I understand what happens. I understand that nothing's going to work except for me to abstain and put the sugar down. And like it was just mentioned on the phone, I am very, very grateful for what I know today about my allergy. And thank you for letting me share. I'll pass.
Thank you, Yolanda. Would anyone else like to comment on what was read?
Risa.
Christine.
I didn't hear who was first before Christy.
Risa.
Go right ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Reese, recovered compulsive overeater. I lock in on the psychic change at the end of this paragraph. It's really laying out the core, starting to lay out the core of the issue. In referring to cravings, does not yet call an obsession, because at a point in the book, it becomes clear, you know, that the understanding is obsession, and it's an obsession that's the using food to medicate, and it's compelled by resentments and things that are going on in your spirit, and in some cases, it talks about your soul. So I know, and I have, I know many in program, and I know I have even eaten abstinent foods compulsively. So there's no one type of food that will elevate you above this obsession if the obsession is not removed from a spiritual experience or a psychic experience. And so it's beginning to unpack that, because if it were controllable, I think the doctor's saying, by altering something that's a consumable, then they could have handled that with science. But a psychic change, a spiritual change, is taking them out of the realm of science, and they're seeing that component, having a God-led process, is what's making the difference and not them. And I can appreciate the comment from earlier saying that, you know, they're trying to come, they will one day come up with something, you know, scientific. Well, it seems that the doctor that we're reading is different than that doctor, in the sense that he gets it, that he's saying I've seen enough to know that what we've come up with is not doing it, but what they're coming up for themselves, which is a God-led process and transition, transformation, is working, and it is what it is. You know, regardless of how we feel about it as scientists, we know what we see. And the spiritual transformation is what's working. And we couldn't make it work. And it really undermines them as professionals. So it was a lot of humility for him to come in and say, I mean, with all of these years and all this money and all this education that we spent, we can't do what they did, you know, giving this all to God. And their higher power, and expecting a spiritual and psychic change. So with that, I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Risa. Christy.
Good morning. Good morning, Janice. Good morning. A Vision for You. This is Christy, and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. And I, too, could probably talk for hours on the, you know, the content in this paragraph. I just love this paragraph. That first sentence, it could read something like, Christy, at the age of 4, 8, because she liked the effect produced by food. Because for me, that is when, you know, when I remember, you know, at the age of 4, I'm 52, and I can't remember what I wore to work last Monday, but I can remember at the age of 4 that feeling that I got, that effect that I got when I ate, when I ingested certain foods. And, you know, later on, I mean, certainly my disease looked different at the age of 4 than it did at the age of 40, but, you know, it didn't get better. I'll just let you in on that part. It did not get better. It got worse. It progressed and, you know, had me feeling like I wanted to crawl out of my skin. You know, that's just what happened with me. You know, for me, you know, I could not, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. You know, for me, the lie became the truth. I couldn't follow food plans that I created. I would come up with something. I'd come up with some scheme. I'd come up with some plan. You know, Christy, I'll just take one of my trigger foods, for example, sugar. And I would tell myself, okay, I'm not going to eat sugar. I'm not going to eat sugar. And what felt like 5 minutes later, I would be saying to myself, you know I said I wasn't going to eat sugar, so I'm not going to eat sugar. I'm not going to eat, like, white granulated sugar. I won't eat that. But what about maple syrup? What about maple syrup? That's not really sugar. What about honey? That's not really sugar. And there I would be off and running. I would be off and running. And I would succumb to that desire again, just like it says in the big book. You know, newsflash, prediction, spoiler alert. Guess what happened? Over and over and over again. Over and over and over again. You know, what the big book outlines for me is what I need to do. First of all, it says the nature of your problem, Christy, is that you have, you know, you have a physical allergy. We've already talked about that in the doctor's opinion. But we also have a craving. We have a craving that is, you know, nothing short of a phenomenon, certainly for me. And what it says here is that that cycle is repeated over and over and over again. For me, I spent 35 years over and over and over again before I experienced an entire psychic change, before that cycle got broken. And the only way that happened for me, you know, I appreciate what I've heard about the medical community. You know, I tried everything. I tried everything, the self-help books, the medical community, you know, the mental health community, all fabulous in their own right. And work for some people did not work for me. What I needed was to put down those foods as it describes in the big book, as it's outlined in the big book, and I needed to work on the greater aspect of my disease by applying the steps and the solution that is outlined in this book. It's there for everybody. It's there for everyone. And I would also not, I mean, I can't imagine experiencing any kind of freedom, the kind of freedom that I've experienced for almost 11 years, for all, without exception, from September 9th of 2001, a freedom that I never thought possible. You could not describe it to me. You could not tell me it would happen. I needed to experience it for myself, and I have, and it's there for everyone, and with that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Christy. Would anyone like to share on what was read?
Good morning, it's Eddie in Virginia.
Hello. Hello, this is Rachel. Compulsive
first
overeater.
First Eddie and then Raquel.
Thank you. Should I unmute? Should I mute now?
Yes, please.
Good morning, all. This is Eddie in Virginia. Grateful to be in recovery today and grateful for having you all here on the line with me. It's nice to know that I'm not alone. When we were reading about the craving and the effect, and the men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, or in my case, by food. Being in the medical field myself for many years, I remember being at a seminar many years ago about addictions, strangely enough about addictions, and one of the speakers talking about addictive behavior said that with any addiction, he was particularly talking about, I believe it was smoking at the time, but that the smoker, when he lights up, that first, if anybody who's ever smoked, and I did, thank God, that was not something I had trouble letting go of, but that first inhale on when you light up a cigarette is the best. It's, and anybody who's ever smoked understands that phenomenon. It always tastes the best. And that you spend the rest of the time chasing that to recreate that effect in the rest of the cigarette. And that the same applies to, for me, in food. You know, that first bite of whatever it is, and in my case, as in many other people in this program, sugar, whatever sugary substance I've ingested, that first bite is like going to heaven. It's, you know, you close your eyes and you think, oh, yes, this is it, you know. And then you spend the rest of your time trying to recreate that effect. And as you progress in your disease, or as I progressed in my disease, I should keep this personal, I found that it took more and more of that particular substance to recreate that effect in me. And that I didn't, you know, it just after a while, it seemed as though my whole existence, my whole life became filled with that chase to recreate that effect. And of course, you know, after a while, it doesn't happen. But you can't see that because you're so consumed. I couldn't see that because I'm so consumed about recreating this effect and sure that the very next bite would bring me that sense of completeness, that sense of fullness, that sense of satisfaction that I really needed in my life. And unfortunately, it took me till I was 58 years old to realize that that was not going to happen.
And when I did realize it, for a while I became quite resentful over the fact that, you know, so-and-so could do this and so could do that, and they didn't have the weight problem that I had, so what was the issue? Of course, the issue was that for them, as we discussed earlier, they got all they needed out of whatever, however many bites they took of their particular food, and then they could move on to other things, and that never occurred to me. Occurred in me, and that would never occur in me, and it took me till I was 58 to realize that would never occur in me. And then it took me another, I don't know, 5 or 6 months to realize, because I found OA, you know, right around my 58th birthday, and it took me another 6 months to get over the fact that I was, excuse my French, pissed off about the fact that it wouldn't happen for me and go back. So thank God I did go back, and I'm grateful every day that I found the rooms, I found all you guys out there who told me that there was a solution, that I too could have this. Because I'd probably be dead today if I hadn't found this. So I know that there's some frustration in trying to share the program. I've found that I have, you know, a sister who's dying of the effects of her disease, my disease, our disease. I have a very good friend who will shortly be in the same boat. And I've tried on many occasions to share my program with them. I realize I can't give it to them, but it, to me, it's so simple. It's so black and white, it's so in your face that I have a hard time stepping back and realizing that they're just not ready to hear the message. But that doesn't mean that I have to stop delivering the message. I can just, you know, live my life as best I can every day, following the steps of the program, in being in tune with my God, and pray for them that they will, you know, get the message just like I did, and that it will impart to their lives all the many gifts that it has given to mine. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Eddie. Raquel, would you like to press star 1 to unmute?
Yes. Hello. Hello, my fellows. This is Raquel. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, thank you so much for being there, and thank God that we're together again in a very such good atmosphere. This I'm a compulsive eater, and I know it. This paragraph is so powerful. I don't even know whether it's not the most important one, without which we really cannot understand the whole book or ourselves. And the previous one about the physical allergy, I have something to say that maybe is going to shock some people, but for me, the addictive behaviors are even stronger of an addiction, I think, than the substances, and I just found out about it a couple of weeks ago. The mere act of chewing for me is addictive. I think even if it were chewing, continuing to eat a salad the whole day long, and chewing makes me feel like not responsible for anything anymore. It takes all the pressure of life off of me. So for me, what I call, and I'm in program already since 1979, I'm not very good in math, but you figure out how many years that is. And it's only through the help of this group 2 years ago that I really, really, I already had then a year and a half of abstinence, but that I realized that for me, that motion of hand to mouth, I call it the hand to mouth resuscitation, is out. I just cannot continue to bring my hand to my mouth. It doesn't depend. Some substances are more dangerous for me than others, like sugar can get me very, very depressed. But, and so I haven't had that for almost 4 years, sugar or flour. But I still can take off on anything that is chewable. No, a gum I had to let go of. So it's very, very complex and very complicated. You know, I have sometimes to sit on my hands. I can't go to places, to people, and sit around their dead chicken Sabbath tables that last forever with the food around, which I call the food parade, and just sit there. And I may sit on my hands and not touch anything, but I'll come home and I'll be frustrated, feel deprived, which means that I am not spiritually recovered yet to the point where I can really be very happy and grateful and not be jealous of the people who can take these things with impunity, because that's just a fact of life. Like, I have no legs, so I should be envy. If I had no legs, would I be envying everybody who can join a marathon of running? Should I sign up for one? Starting with the food is like signing up for a marathon of running when I'm in a wheelchair. So the acceptance of the fact that I cannot chew like other people for pleasure is quite a piece of a big frog to swallow, but it's happening more and more. What helps me a lot is to say to myself when I look at whatever, mostly when I'm upset about something, is, what are you hungry for now? And I pretend like that object is some kind of a deity, and I'm now about to bow down to whatever it is, that food, and say, oh, holy whatever, bagel or whatever, wouldst thou save me from what God can't? And then it becomes ridiculous. But now, thank goodness, I can be with you every day again, and it fills my heart, and it be sane and purposeful. And I know that for me, what it says here, that the effect of produced by alcohol, for me, it's even the effect produced by being like a little baby with a pacifier in my mouth, by chewing. I hope maybe it talks to somebody else. I'm not using my alibis anymore, that because I'm a Holocaust survivor and bread was our staff of life, I can't do that anymore. Other people became like me without having gone through what I went through, but this is very helpful to me, this paragraph. Thank you very much for letting me share, and I pass.
Thank you, Raquel. Would anyone else like to share on what was read?
Yes, this is Amy.
And Leah.
Go ahead, Amy.
And then Leah.
Good morning. My name is Amy. I am a compulsive overeater. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. What are we talking about here? Yesterday we were talking about the allergy and the mental obsession. This is the mental obsession. When I would go down the grocery store aisles looking for that perfect binge food, looking for that perfect high, you know, what would get it done for me? I hadn't triggered my allergy. This was my mind when it comes to compulsive overeating was warped. You know, to me, I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. Everything I thought about had to do with how I was going to find the ease and comfort of the next bite. And this was before I even triggered the allergy. This is the mental obsession that is so injurious to all of us who are compulsive overeaters, because we think that what we are doing is rational, even though it's injurious. It's insanity. It is insanity. That's what the mental obsession is. When it came to my thinking around food, I was insane. And it didn't matter how injurious it would be to me. I would think of some crazy reason to think, oh, this food would do it for me this time, or it won't bother me this time, or I can eat that and it won't do anything to me. I was looking for a sense of ease and comfort. I was restless and irritable before I even put the bite in my mouth. So this is why if someone comes up with a cure for the, you know, highs and lows of blood sugar or a pill or something like that, it wouldn't affect me, because I need a psychic change. I need a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. I need the transformation that comes through working the 12 steps that allows me the freedom to not think in such a warped and insane way before I even trigger the allergy. We need to understand the very, very cunning and baffling nature of this disease that comes via the mental obsession. We need a psychic change through the 12 steps. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Amy. Leah.
Thank you so much, Janice. Good morning, everybody. My name is Leah. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. Such a fantastic paragraph, because it clearly describes the cycle that we go through. It says here, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect by alcohol. I compulsively overeat certain substances because I like the effect produced by them. I mean, I do like the taste of farm fresh vegetables. I do. But I never went out in the middle of the night to pursue a Brussels sprout. It just didn't give me the buzz I was looking for. There are certain substances that give me an effect. It's called numbing out. It's called anesthetizing. It's called finding the comfort, the ease in a cellophane bag or a bakery box. I want to numb out. I'm looking for a particular effect. Yes, I might like other things, you know, but I'm looking to buffer myself, to numb out, and give myself that sense of ease and comfort. And the sensation is so elusive, it's so mysterious, that even though I admit that this process injures me, even though I know that there is pain, even though I go to bed at night crying, tears running down my cheeks and onto my pillow, even though I have suicidal thinking, even though this process is bringing tremendous emotional turmoil, mental torture, medical consequences, suicidal thinking, I cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false because this abnormal way of living has become the norm for me because I can't remember the pain and I can't remember the suffering and I can't remember the threats of divorce and I can't remember the fact that I want to slice my wrist. I can't remember that. All I want to think about is the fact that there are contents in a bakery box that allow me to take a trip out of here and to numb out. It says to them their alcoholic life seems the only normal one because I've been doing it for so long. The abnormal has become the norm for me. They are restless, irritable, and discontent unless they again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few bites. Bites which I see other people taking without consequences, but the deal is I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I can't live life on life's terms. And so here we go. After they have succumbed to the desire again, meaning even after I eliminate those substances, even after I swear off, I'm never going to do that again. I'm not going to eat that way again. I'm not going to binge my brains out again. I'm not going to do that. Even after I do that, it says after they have succumbed to the desire again, my real problem is that obsession of the mind, the insanity. That even though I have sworn off and even though I am abstinent, there comes a time, it might be weeks later, it might be months later, when I am abstinent. I can't take the restlessness, the irritability, and the discontent. And so after they have succumbed, meaning I invite back in the disease, I invite it back in. I direct my hand to the counter, and I put those contents of that cellophane bag into my mouth. I yield to it. I invite it in. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, because once I put that substance in my body, then it triggers a phenomenon of craving. The only way an alcoholic can crave alcohol is to first put it in his system, and then the phenomenon of craving develops, and then we can't stop, and then he ends up getting drunk and sick. So, you know, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution. I am never going to binge again. I'm not going to binge my brains out tonight. I'm not going to do that to myself again. That is the cycle. This is a clearly taught paragraph about the allergy of the body. The fact that there are certain substances, when I put them in my body, they trigger that phenomenon of craving and the obsession of the mind, which is the greater aspect of my disease. And with that, I pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Leah. Would anyone else like to comment on what was read?
Good morning. Hi. I do. I'd love to have one.
I can hear someone, if you would mute your line, please. Thank you.
This is Reva.
Anyone else?
This is Reva.
Go ahead, Reva.
Hi, this is Reva, grateful, recovered, compulsive overeater. The numbing out is really, well, so the effect that it produced was something that really spoke to me, this paragraph. I remember so clearly when I first came to OA, I would come to these meetings and people would talk about how much better their life had become. I thought I had the miracle cure. And I was in for a rude wake-up call when I started eating and all of a sudden my way to measure plans. And all of a sudden, I was living in a much worse situation than I ever did before. And I was shocked by that. But I suddenly realized that, you know, I'm not numb anymore. I can feel my feelings. I don't have a way to drown out my feelings. So I was eating to numb myself without even realizing I was doing it. I guess that's the denial part. I was lying to myself. And that was the one aspect, and I liked that part of it. I liked the fact that I was able to numb myself before, which is why I kept eating. I liked that effect. I didn't even realize the downside of it, though, that I couldn't have normal conversations with any human beings when I was in the food. I was in such a fog. I was so numb that when I ate these substances that I'm allergic to, that my memory was gone, and I couldn't focus on a conversation for long enough to hear it from beginning to end. And I think my husband used to get frustrated sometimes. He would be talking to me about something important, or if I was trying to discuss spiritual matters with the people, and I would just zone out the minute people started talking. And I would leave these conversations having no idea what was said. So that was the frustrating part of it, but I didn't even realize that this was why I blamed it on other things. I blamed it on having kids. I blamed it on lots of many different things. But when I stopped eating compulsively and I stopped eating trigger foods, then I started realizing that really, in fact, it had been the fog all along that was created by these foods that I'm allergic to. And I'm very grateful not to be here now. Now, after learning how to deal with my feelings through the 12 steps, I not only don't need to numb myself anymore, but I can say that my life is happier now than it has ever been before. Thank you. With that, I pass.
Thank you, Eva. Would anyone else like to comment on what was read? Press star 1 to unmute. All right, let's move on to the next paragraph. Katie F., if you would please read for us.
Okay, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Well, I think this is just the great news after all of this talk that we have had about, wanting the medical community. It just kills me that they don't understand it, that they don't get it, that we are the same as alcoholics, that we have a obsession of the mind as well as the physical allergy. But the miracle is that when we pick up this program and we follow these few simple rules, we can recover. And I was the least likely person to get recovery. I sat in these rooms for 6 years. I would be absent for a day or two, a week or two, and then I would make up my own rules, and I would not follow what other people were telling me to do, and I would be back in the food. But once I understood, and it was clearly explained to me that I had to follow these rules every day, and that I could not ever go back to eating whatever I wanted, and even I just did not want to have to monitor so closely what I ate. I have to weigh and measure. That is what I have to do because, like the woman who shared earlier, I have a chewing problem. I can't have hand-to-mouth. I can't have open-ended. You can have as much lettuce as you want. I have to eat a specific amount of food, specific times a day, and that's what I have to do. And the strange thing is I was able to walk out of my job on October 7th, 1987, having binged all day. I found out about a program that explained this process to me, and I have not had to pick up the food ever again since that day. I worked in a restaurant. I was constantly around food, and yet my brain, through God's grace, had a psychic change overnight. And that didn't mean that after a few months, a few weeks, a few years, I could go back to just picking up here and there. I have to do what I do every day. My program has not gotten easier. It has not gotten softer. I do not do less than I did when I came in. I do more because this is a progressive disease, but there is recovery. All you have to do is follow a few simple rules. With that, I pass.
Thank you, Katie. Would anyone else like to comment on what was read?
It's Deb.
This is Paula. May I ask you?
Did I hear Deb?
Yeah, hi.
Deb and then Paula.
Thank
you. Go ahead, Deb.
Thank you. Thank you, Janice. Good morning, A Vision for You. My name is Deb. I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. Thank you, God. I, too, want to say there's just so much hope in this small little paragraph. And one of the things that it just totally reminds me of is in how it works. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. There it is, that word again, simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. But the cool thing about this is, you know, that honesty, that willingness, that realization that we were made for more, there's just so much hope here. I love how it says, you know, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Those few simple rules, one, you have to have a sponsor. You have to have somebody who can look at what you're eating, can help you identify what it is that you need to put down. I mean, because that's, you know, part of the problem. You know, it's a twofold disease. We have an allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And unfortunately, a lot of times it's the obsession of the mind that kicks in first. But if we don't identify what those particular trigger and binge foods are, you know, we're not going to know. We're not going to know what we don't know. But once that person can help you identify what that is, and then you can start implementing this, these steps, it is a simple program. And there's so much freedom in that, as long as you stay honest and willing to allow God just to work through you and continue on this path. And so I just think that is just absolutely awesome. And with that, I'll pass. Thanks.
Thank you, Deb. Go ahead, Paula.
Thank you. This would be Paula, recovered compulsive overeater. You know, I was just looking at that word and just the sentence before. Again, repeated, entire psychic change. No partway here. No partway. This has to be complete. And then it says, now that sounded, that whole paragraph before, outside of that last line, sounded so hopeless, but look what it brought us into. It brought us into hope. It has, on the other hand, on this hand you hold this, on the other hand. And then it says, as strange, and Lord knows. It did sound strange, sounded impossible, as this may seem to those who do not understand. Once a psychic change has occurred, that very same person, here you see the transformation of a life. It says so clearly, who seemed doomed. Honey, he was doomed. There was no doubt in my mind. This was the path I was going. But then I just look at the way it ends. Suddenly, how does this happen? Few simple rules, finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. But you know that psychic, that's the mind. The mind goes first in recovery and in addiction. The mind starts it. And then it says completely, the only effort necessary, this is all, being that required to follow. And there it is. No leading for you anymore, honey. No leading for you. You step aside and you follow. Follow a few simple rules. Thank you for allowing me to share, and with that, I do pass.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you. Well, we're going to close here, and thank you for everyone who has shared today. And we will now close with the reading from the Big Book on page 164, followed by the Serenity Prayer. Would you please read for us, Deb?
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Janice. Deb, compulsive overeater from Michigan. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great effect for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.